Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is a special privilege as well as personal delight to be able to welcome to our microphones for a full hour a man of uncommon intelligence. These days, he is the founder and president of an important organization that does incalculably important work, helping every one of us understand our history, our heritage, and how it bears on our future. The outfit is called Wall Builders, and he is a wall builder of the First Order. He has served in the past in the Republican Party of his native Texas. He has been involved with the presidential campaign of 2016, of Senator Ted Cruz, as the director of Keep the Promise PAC. He is a good friend and a constant source of inspiration, a man of great faith as well as high intellect, and always a welcome guest here. David Barton, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Good to have you.
All right. Good to be with you, sir. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm going to shamelessly acknowledge that I'm inspired in part to catch up with you, only in part, because it had been on my agenda for some time and we've had some challenges getting schedules to work. But I did catch your appearance recently on the podcast with my friend Ben Shapiro, and it was marvelous. So I want to sort of reprise some of the important things that you covered with him and commend to our listeners to check out Ben's podcast with David Barton. But let's start by just giving a little bit more detail about your personal history and trajectory, David. You didn't come to faith and your interest in history terribly directly, and it's a great story. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I was a guy who did not like history. I stayed away from it. The four things in my life growing up that I stayed away from were history and law and government and politics. And so those four things were things I did not care for. I was raised in a very small country town. Our town had 220 folks in it. I rode my horse back and forth to work. It was a very small rural area. And in areas like that, we just want government to stay out of our hair, leave us alone. Just stay away. Don't like politics. Stay out of it. Same with government. I did not like history because I had had history in school. I had in college. It was extremely boring, extremely non-relevant. And quite frankly, the teachers I had, I didn't know at the time, but the way they taught and what they taught was completely wrong. I had my sixth grade history teacher told me that George Washington had 26 illegitimate children, giving new meaning to the phrase, Washington slept here. And I thought, gosh, if that's our history, I can do without that. So that's what I had. What changed me was literally I came across two very old documents that I've been taught about in school. But when I read the actual document, they were completely and totally different than what I had been told about in history classes. And so the more I looked at the actual originals, the more I said, oh my gosh, this stuff is really cool. This is fun. This is not what I was taught. And so that's where we got started collecting originals. And now we have about 120,000 from before 1812. So I have thousands of the original items of the George Washington's and Adams and Jefferson's and Madison's. And what I was told about those guys was not at all accurate. And what actual history is so much more fun and so much more applicable. I mean, there actually is a lot we can apply. So this really kind of got me going in the other direction. Same with government law and politics. I found that, you know, a lot of the stuff I believe, it's not being put into practice or policy. And I think it's common sense stuff. And if I want it there, I'm going to have to get involved in government to try to get better people elected, to try to see things from a different worldview and try to get a reasonable position in there. And so now we are intimately involved in political things, and I'm recruited hundreds for office, trained thousands for office. I held office for 9 years myself. So it's a whole different world from the way I was raised.
Yeah, talk about turnarounds. It really is an amazing, God thing, I think, because what you've done, David, is you've brought to bear all of those wonderful qualities. Your sort of disciplined mind, your ability to do research, your storytelling capabilities to really educate countless numbers of people, in addition to the folks in elective office or would-be elective office that you're focused on at the moment. Of course, at Wall Builders, you've been teaching a lot of us along the trail, and not least through your books. Am I right that there are 17 of them to date?
You know, Frank, I don't really count, but the office recently told me that we've written over 40 books. So
no wonder you can't count. I've got 17 here in front of me, so it's an impressive body of work, needless to say. But before we turn to some of that, David, just tell us a little bit about your collection and what you do with it to help put people in touch with their, as I say, heritage.
Well, one of the things that let me just hit the name Wall Builders for a minute, because Wall Builders, and with this day and age, no, we are not building the wall on the southern border. I mean, not that I'm opposed to that at all, but this is a Bible name that comes from Nehemiah recalling the people to rebuild that which had been torn down. In that case, it was Jerusalem. They had been 70 years away from it in captivity in Babylon. They're going back to make Israel a great nation again, and the people who went with him really were the dregs of the society. The bright, sharp people stayed behind in Babylon. He had the poor people with him, and they looked at that task of rebuilding the city of Jerusalem and said, "You got to be kidding. There's no way we can put all these stones back together, et cetera." He said, "Guys, if we all do something, we can get it done." And so 52 days later, the city of Jerusalem was rebuilt, and it was something none of them expected. It was because everyone got involved and did something. And so that's the message we like. So from that, we believe that there's a lot of things that can be rebuilt in America, and we particularly say our religious, moral, and constitutional heritage. And we do that through history. Right now, we're in the midst of a two-week training session. We take young people 18 to 25. We know they're going into college, they're in college, or they're in postgraduate work, and we don't think they're taught in college because we speak there all the time. And so what we do is we take them through the apologetics on America, the apologetics on faith, the apologetics on the free market, the apologetics on all these things that are attacked in the culture. And we let them handle all the original documents relating to all those areas. And they go out of here completely transformed. Every session, it seems like we get word back from one of these kids who has changed their professor, and the professor is not going in a different direction. So we do a lot of training there. We have a network of about 1,000 state legislators that we work with, legislation in all 50 states we work on. At the federal level, there's probably about 120 members of Congress that we work with closely. I do a lot of things with congressional members. We do congressional delegations, take them overseas, looking at security things in other nations. We do a lot with teachers. We just finished two of our teacher training sessions where we bring in everything from university presidents down to 8th grade history teachers and do trainings with them.
David, we have to pause. When we come back, I want to talk to you about apologetics. A lot to talk about with David Barton of Wall Builders right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is a special privilege as well as personal delight to be able to welcome to our microphones for a full hour a man of uncommon intelligence. These days, he is the founder and president of an important organization that does incalculably important work helping every one of us understand our history, our heritage, and how it bears on our future. The outfit is called Wall Builders, and he is a wall builder of the First Order. He has served in the past in the Republican Party of his native Texas. He has been involved with the presidential campaign of 2016, of Senator Ted Cruz, as the director of Keep the Promise PAC. He is a good friend and an constant source of inspiration, a man of great faith as well as high intellect, and always a welcome guest here. David Barton, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Good to have you.
All right. Good to be with you, sir. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm going to shamelessly acknowledge that I'm inspired in part to catch up with you, only in part, because it had been on my agenda for some time and we've had some challenges getting schedules to work, but I did catch your appearance recently on the podcast with my friend Ben Shapiro, and it was marvelous. So I want to sort of reprise some of the important things that you covered with him and commend to our listeners to check out Ben's podcast with David Barton. But let's start by just giving a little bit more detail about your personal history and trajectory, David. You didn't come to faith and your interest in history terribly directly, and it's a great story. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I was a guy who did not like history. I stayed away from it. The four things in my life growing up that I stayed away from were history and law and government and politics. And so those four things were things I did not care for. I was raised in a very small country town. Our town had 220 folks in it. I rode my horse back and forth to work. It was a very small rural area. And in areas like that, we just want government to stay out of our hair, leave us alone, and just stay away. Don't like politics, stay out of it. Same with government. I did not like history because I had had history in school. I had in college. It was extremely boring, extremely non-relevant. And quite frankly, the teachers I had, I didn't know at the time, but the way they taught and what they taught was completely wrong. I had my sixth grade history teacher told me that George Washington had 26 illegitimate children, giving new meaning to the phrase, Washington slept here. And I thought, gosh, if that's our history, I can do without that. So that's what I had. What changed me was literally I came across two very old documents that I've been taught about in school. But when I read the actual document, they were completely and totally different than what I had been told about in history classes. And so the more I looked at the actual originals, the more I said, oh my gosh, this stuff is really cool. This is fun. This is not what I was taught. And so that's where we got started collecting originals. And now we have about 120,000 from before 1812. So I have thousands of the original items of the George Washington's and Adams and Jefferson's and Madison's. And what I was told about those guys was not at all accurate. And what actual history is so much more fun and so much more applicable. I mean, there actually is a lot we can apply. So this really kind of got me going in the other direction. Same with government law and politics. I found that, you know, a lot of the stuff I believe, it's not being put into practice or policy. And I think it's common sense stuff. And if I want it there, I'm going to have to get involved in government to try to get better people elected, to try to see things from a different worldview and try to get a reasonable position in there. And so now we are intimately involved in political things, and I've recruited hundreds for office, trained thousands for office. I held office for 9 years myself. So it's a whole different world from the way I was raised.
Yeah, talk about turnarounds. It really is an amazing, God thing, I think, because what you've done, David, is you've brought to bear all of those wonderful qualities. You're sort of disciplined mind, your ability to do research, your storytelling capabilities to really educate countless numbers of people, in addition to the folks in elective office or would-be elective office that you're focused on at the moment. Of course, at Wall Builders, you've been teaching a lot of us along the trail, and not least through your books. Am I right that there are 17 of them to date?
You know, Frank, I don't really count, but the office recently told me that we've uh, we've written over 40 books. So
no wonder you can't count. I've got 17 here in front of me. So it's an impressive body of work, needless to say. But before we turn to some of that, David, just tell us a little bit about your collection and what you do with it to help put people in touch with their, as I say, heritage.
Well, one of the things that let me just hit the name Wall Builders for a minute, because Wall Builders, and with this day and age, no, we are not building the wall on the southern border. I mean, not that I'm opposed to that at all, but this is a Bible name that comes from Nehemiah recalling the people to rebuild that which had been torn down. In that case, it was Jerusalem. They had been 70 years away from it in captivity in Babylon. They're going back to make Israel a great nation again, and the people who went with him really were the dregs of the society. The bright, sharp people stayed behind in Babylon. He had the poor people with him, and they looked at that task of rebuilding the city of Jerusalem and said, "You got to be kidding. There's no way we can put all these stones back together, et cetera." And he said, "Guys, if we all do something, we can get it done." And so 52 days later, the city of Jerusalem was rebuilt, and it was something none of them expected. It was because everyone got involved and did something. And so that's the message we like. So from that, we believe that there's a lot of things that can be rebuilt in America, and we particularly say our religious, moral, and constitutional heritage. And we do that through history. Right now, we're in the midst of a two-week training session. We take young people 18 to 25. We know they're going into college. They're in college or they're in postgraduate work, and we don't think they're taught in college because we speak there all the time. And so what we do is we take them through the apologetics on America, the apologetics on faith, the apologetics on the free market, the apologetics on all these things that are attacked in the culture. And we let them handle all the original documents relating to all those areas. And they go out of here completely transformed. Every session, it seems like we get word back from one of these kids who has changed their professor, and the professor is not going in a different direction. So we do a lot of training there. We have a network of about 1,000 state legislators that we work with, legislation in all 50 states we work on. At the federal level, there's probably about 120 members of Congress that we work with closely. I do a lot of things with congressional members. We do congressional delegations, take them overseas, looking at security things in other nations. We do a lot with teachers. We just finished two of our teacher training sessions where we bring in everything from university presidents down to 8th grade history teachers and do trainings with them.
David, we have to pause. When we come back, I want to talk to you about apologetics. A lot to talk about with David Barton of Wall Builders right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Pure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. David Barton of Wall Builders is in the house. He is one of my favorite people on the planet and a man that I've had the privilege of knowing and working with a bit over the years, in particular in connection with what you might call his pedagogy, his efforts to teach. He does it exceptionally well, using frequently original materials that he has acquired over decades of collecting and that he has been able to use as real teaching tools about specifically the founding of our country, what motivated the founders, what they believed, and what they imparted to the rest of us in the way of this extraordinary constitutional republic and the freedoms that it guarantees. And David, I wanted, before we get into some of that, I just to ask you to define a term. It's probably better known and understood by people of faith, but you used it in several different contexts, and that is the word apologetics. It always conjures up in my mind the idea that you're actually, you know, trying to apologize, but that's not the idea at all, is it?
Yeah, the word apologetics is a word that really goes back to several French words and Latin words and early words in the 1600s, but it really means to be able to give the reasons why you believe what you believe. I think the oldest way I've seen it used is in the Bible in 1 Peter 3:15, where Peter says, "Give a reason for the hope that's within you." Most people can give an answer, they can't give a reason. Should we be this or that, you know, conservative or whatever? Give me the reasons. Well, we just always have been. No, give me the reasons. And so what happens is we train our kids with the right values. We send them off to college. And right now we know that between 81 and 80% of kids who have been raised in Christian homes and Christian churches will deny their faith while they're at college right now. And that's because they know what they believe. They don't know why they believe it. And so when a professor starts asking them very difficult questions and they're suddenly finding, you know, I don't have any answers. He's a lot smarter than I am. He's got 14 PhDs. I can't believe my parents got me to believe this garbage. And so that's why we're losing our kids at a high rate at the academic level is we can't defend that. We know that right now 75% of kids in college support socialism, 69% of millennials support socialism, and 41% of the nation overall support socialism. I don't think we have ever lost an argument with the socialists because when we ask them why they believe what they believe and make them prove it, they can't do it. They've just been taught that. Their professors have taught them that this is the most fair, equitable sharing way. And then you start saying, okay, so what about this? How about this? I think one of the greatest examples I've seen of this is George Barna. We do a lot of national polling work with George Barna. And Barna found he's the one that identified 41% of the nation believes in socialism. But I love Barna because he doesn't let you get away with just stopping there. He wants to know if you know why you believe what you believe. So he asked an additional 36 questions of all the respondents and asked some questions really that defined socialism. They didn't know that. But he said, do you think there should be government greater government regulation of private business? Do you think there should be greater government ownership of private property, et cetera? And overwhelmingly, it was no. And he found out at the end that actually only 2% of Americans support socialism when they know what it is. And so this is where apologetics becomes so important. Is we live, and this is, you know, longer than we want to get into, but shortly, back in the 1930s, there was a massive change in the pedagogy of education, where we made an emphasis on teaching kids how to be learners rather than thinkers. And learners means you just receive whatever someone tells you, just it comes in, which is why indoctrination is so easy now. Thinkers say, no, wait a minute, let's look at all the sides of this, and let's consider it. And so with 100 years of learners now instead of thinkers, this is where it is so easy for the left to move us in directions because they use sound bites, they use memes, they use all the shallow stuff. Apologetics cuts through all of that and says, what's the reason behind it? So that's why we teach apologetics and all the training we do is know why you believe what you believe.
So apologetics has, I guess, a shared root with the word apology, but it's really explaining. It's you know, teaching as much as anything, is it not?
Yeah, it's explaining and defending. Back in the old days, the word apology was used like there would be an apology for anti-slavery. Well, they're not apologizing. What they're doing is setting forth the treatise on why all men are created equal. And so writings were very common throughout the 1400s, 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, and early 1900s, where that there would be an apology for the Republican Party. Well, they're not apologizing for it. They're setting forth the reasons that the Republicans do what they do. Or there would be an apology for immigration or whatever. And so the word apology always meant a defense for, a reasonable intellectual defense for. And that's what apologetics is being able to give a defense for what you believe and being able to articulate the reasons why you believe what you believe. And that's hard for people to do most of the time today.
Well, and talk us through that bit that you sort of touched on there a moment ago. It's hard for us to do because we've focused on learning in a manner that is not actually equipping us to engage in such an informed defense. And you also use the term indoctrination. Tell us, in your estimation, David Barton, why is it that we've got those appalling numbers of uninformed, arguably uneducated, non-thinking kids who are so susceptible to the superficial descriptions of and seduction, really, of things like socialism?
Yeah, one of the things that happens is in the 1920s, it's a movement that started in the 1880s in America, but in the 1920s, progressives had control of most educational positions. And so they came up with five major pedagogical shifts in the 1920s. And they all deal with, we're going to move from thinking to learning. And the difference is, when we were doing teaching thinking, we taught students how to think, and that was we taught them how to use their mind. When we go to learning, now the emphasis is on the teacher, and you need to know what the teacher knows and what the teacher says. See, the difference is we used to teach students how to fish, and now we start giving them fish. And so it's striking, and this is, I think, is one of the most telling aspects of the change. In the 1920s is the first time you will ever see true, false, fill in the blank, or multiple choice test. Because we are saying, all right, student, did I, the teacher, tell you this, true or false? Did I tell you A, B, C, or D? I told you blank. And so what we're doing now is we're getting the kids to recite back what the teacher told them. And that's learning, not thinking. We have a great series of books that the founding fathers used, and we used in the 1800s, that showed how to think. There's a great book called The Improvement of the Mind by Isaac Watts, we used for generations. Another was the use of what they called forensics. And I have to admit, I did not know what they meant by forensics, because I've watched enough NCIS and other programs to think, well, that's when Abby dissects somebody. It was totally different. And they gave a list of forensics. And there was always, they had debates over issues that could not be won on a right or wrong basis. And here was one of them. The question is, the patriots who dumped the tea in Boston Harbor in 1773, the Boston Tea Party, was that an act of rebellion that should be condemned for destruction of private property, or was that an act of patriotism that should be praised for standing up against tyranny? Now, I can see the answer to that going either way, and that was exactly the point. The professor of the class would come in and say, here's the debate. All right, Frank, you take for, and David, you take against. Let's see you guys go at it right now. And it didn't really matter what I believed. I had to be able to pick out the weaknesses in your arguments. I had to be able to see what your logic was and say, ooh, well, that's a good point. How am I going to counter that? And then we would reverse the roles. And then now I would defend the other side, and you would take the other side. And so what it taught us was to look for both sides, to consider questions that might not have been presented or what you presented, because you're going to present in a way that makes your point, but there's more to it that I need to be aware of. And so it taught us how to think. And so through a series of forensics of questions that made you think, we learned to say, wait a minute, what's your proof for that? What's the basis for that? Oh, you overlooked this fact. And so as citizens, we were quite able to see through what happened in Washington, D.C. We were quite able to see through what happened with political parties. We just had a whole different type of students there, a whole different type of citizens, because we trained them to think, not to learn. And that's the big change that happened in the 1920s.
David, I will never forget sitting with you in a diner out in your town west of Fort Worth, and having you describe the trends that are really quite troubling about what is going on in our country today. And you said something that just riveted me. You said the trends all started turning in the wrong direction in 1962, as I recall. And it had something to do with schools. It had something to do with the Supreme Court. It had something to do with faith. Connect those dots for us with you. And we may need to spill over into the next block, but I just wanted to get started on this really important point.
Yeah, what happened is, for me, I grew up as a math and science guy, and math and science was my stuff. I taught that. I was a student instructor in college as well. And so I had a lot of experience with math and science. That was my scholarship when I went to college. And math and science is all about metrics. It's about being able to measure and prove things. And so that was my background. So now that I get over into politics, for me, it's pretty simple. Hey, does this work or not work? Well, let's measure it and see. Today, we do so many things that we say work or don't work based on it's a good idea. And we never get around to measuring it, which is why things like Common Core, if we'd ever measured it before we put it in place, we would have known it would not work. But now we know it doesn't work because we put it in place in 24 states and scores have all gone down. So We're in a culture that doesn't use metrics very much, but I was into metrics.
David, we're pausing for just 1 second. We'll be right back with more and finishing this important insight into what has been going on in our schools and as a result in our society more generally. That and much more with the great David Barton of Wall Builders.
More with Frank Gaffney.
David Barton is in the house virtually, a dear friend, a much admired colleague, and a great resource for our country and its leaders. And David, I just wanted to get you to walk us through this story about how the Supreme Court engaged in a very important case back in 1962, as I recall, and what flowed from that case.
Yeah, what happened for me, that my story, I was in education. I was a math and science teacher. I was a basketball coach. I became a principal of the school. I ran the school. And as such, I had opportunity. This is when I was still really did not like politics and wanted to stay out of it. And my wife was invited to go to a conference in Washington, D.C. and meet with her congressman. And I didn't have any interest in meeting the congressman. And so I literally prayed about it and said, you know, all right, let's pray. Should we go? And I thought, well, I prayed. Now I can say, no, I'm not going. But when I prayed, I really felt like in my heart that you should be there. You should go to D.C. You should meet with this congressman. I don't want to meet with a congressman. I don't even know a congressman. And so for the next 6 weeks, every morning when I got up and every night before I go to bed, I had two haunting questions I could not get out of my mind. And one is, find out what happened to SAT score since World War II. And the second is, find out when God was taken out of the public arena. Find out when prayer was taken out of schools and Bible and voluntary faith taken out. And in both of those, I said, these are the dumbest questions I've ever heard. It really doesn't matter what happened with SAT scores since World War II. I'm a principal in the 80s, and so I knew the 70s and the 80s and the SAT scores and getting my kids ready for college, et cetera. And then why do I care when God is taken out of school? We haven't ever had God's school. I grew up and we didn't have anything going to God's school. What is this all about? And so the first thing that I did, I just could not get rid of these questions. So I finally went to the educational library. I looked up what happened with SAT scores, and it was very interesting. SAT test goes back to 1926. And as you look at SAT scores, every year the national average for the sciences and the reading side, everything, they bounced around at a particular level for dozens of years. And then they got to 1962, 1963, and they plummeted for 17 straight years, and they lost nearly 15% of their value. And you look at that as a science guy, and you go, wait a minute. If I plot this chart out, it's going straight like you're rolling a marble across a table, and then it gets to the end of the table, and it plummets straight toward the base of the floor. And when you see a chart like that in science, there's two things that happen to change the direction of the chart. One is it gets a steady pressure from the outside, and so it changes like you're driving around a curve. You know how a car slowly goes around a curve. Or it's like it got broadsided at an intersection and takes an instant new direction. And so what happened was when I looked at that chart, it's the kind of a chart that was going straight down the highway. It got broadsided from something on the side, and suddenly it goes in a new direction. And so I thought, I wonder what happened in 1962, 63. And so then I went to the law library and I said, I want to see when the Supreme Court first became hostile to religion and public life, and looked it up, and it was 1962, 1963. And so I laid that out, and there was a perfect correlation. I go, my gosh, this, you know, statistically, if I see this as a scientist, this is pretty significant stuff. So in D.C., I showed it to a congressman. I said, have you ever seen anything like this before? And he was quiet for almost 1 minute, didn't say anything. He looked at it, tapped his table, tapped his fingers. He said, we've debated God in schools a lot. We've never seen statistics. He said, somebody ought to research this. And so when he said that, it was like I had a commission. So I went back and I started looking, because the prayer that was prayed by the people when the court took it out, the school prayer was, Almighty God, we acknowledge our dependence on thee. We beg thy blessings upon us, our parents, our teachers, and our country. Amen. So it was not a Christian prayer. It was a prayer that was created by Jews, Christians, Catholics, and Protestants, also Greek Orthodox. It was a voluntary prayer, you could say, if you used. But you had in the vicinity of 43 million kids that could say that prayer every day, and suddenly they can't say it anymore. And so when I looked at that prayer, it said over us as students, over our parents, that's our family, over our teachers, that's our schools, over our country, that's the nation. So I went to cabinet-level departments and just said, I want all the stats you got on the major categories you keep. And there were 47 different categories, and they ran everything from violent crime through divorce through whatever. And every single one of them, without exception, broke violently in 1962, 1963. It's like we said, God, get the heck out of our life. We don't need you anymore. I said, okay, you want it your way? Have it your way. So that became astounding that we found all those cases, because you should have a scatter pattern. Something should have broken 68, something should have broken 74, something should have broken 57. They all broke 62, 63. So the next thing we did was counter research, because you look for double correlation. If you're saying that taking it out made a difference, can you see if putting it back in returns it to the former state? And particularly with education at that point, we had 12% of the nation that was in private schools. Christian schools, they still use the Bible and prayer in schools, and their SAT scores were the same as the nation had been prior to 62-63. It's like they never had a change in scores. But for the secular schools that took God out, there was a plummeting of scores. And so that's what really got us started.
It's pretty dispositive, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. The double correlation.
Yeah, double correlation. Exactly right. So, David, one of the things that we've been focusing a lot on, and you've been very helpful with, is trying to save persecuted Christians around the world. And in part, as we've seen just this week in this Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom convened by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, there's been a lot of talk about religious freedom. Talk about the founders and what they envisioned, what their thinking was about religious freedom, its primacy in our constitutional rights, and the degree to which they didn't mean exactly the kind of separation of church and state that the Supreme Court sort of conjured up in that 62-63 timeframe.
Yeah, separation of church and state is a very, very important concept. It comes directly from God. It is in the scriptures. It is where that God first says, Moses, you're over the civil stuff in the nation. Aaron, you're over the spiritual stuff in the nation. We did not let one person rule both church and state. When a king tried to do that in the Bible in 2 Chronicles 26, King Uzziah tried to be both king and priest. God struck him down, said, no, you're king. I've got priests. Don't need you being priest. So that was the way it was in the Christian church for the first 300 years. It changed in 381 AD when Emperor Theodosius said, hey, I'm a Christian. I'm the emperor of the world. Here's the new standard. Everybody will be Christians or I will kill you. And so that's the first time we have the state taking over the church. And separation of church and state was never because the church took over the state. It was always the government taking over the church and decreeing doctrines and punishing those who didn't believe the right doctrines. So you have 1,200 years of that. That's called the Age of Apostasy. It changes with the Reformation. The Reformation guys say, hey, we got to go back to separation church and state. The government should not be telling us what our doctrines are. And at that time, you had, particularly for the American experience, you had Henry VIII and others who had created their own state church so they could give themselves the doctrines they wanted. And they said, here's the form of communion you will take, transubstantiation versus consubstantiation. Here's how you'll do baptism. I mean, the state was dictating everything. And if you did not follow what the state said, you were thrown in jail. So in the case of the Pilgrims, who were one of the early groups to come here, when their pastor said, look, Jesus Christ is the head of the Christian church, not the king, he was killed by the king, actually by Queen Elizabeth, who was the daughter of Henry VIII. She said, no, I am the head of the church. I will tell you what to believe. Because he made that statement, he was killed. And so that's when the Pilgrims went to Holland and finally came to America. But that was common across Europe, that every state established denomination. You had the Christians, the Christian kings who said, you know what, it's Jews who killed Jesus, so let's go kill some Jews. Jesus would be happy. So in 1015, there were 15,000 Jews killed in the Rhine Valley, all to make Jesus happy because that's what the state said. So that's the kind of stuff that led to separation church and state. And the Reformation, that's where you see the rise of that phrase. So when Jefferson used that phrase, separation church and state, he's the one we credit with in America. He was talking completely in the sense of his state of Virginia, an Anglican state, established state. They had the Anglican Church of Virginia. And in his state, the Anglican Church was killing Quakers who were preaching without a license. They were imprisoning Baptists for preaching without an Anglican license. They were doing the same to Methodists and others. And Jefferson said, no, there's got to be a separation of church and state. The government can't tell you what to do with your religion or where to practice it or how. So when he became president of the United States, he got a letter from the Danbury Baptists in Connecticut that said, hey, we're afraid the government's going to stop our religious activities. He said, no way. There's a separation of church and state in America. The government will not stop your religious activities. So that letter he wrote, 233 words, three paragraphs long, was cited by the courts for the next 150 years to keep religious expressions in public. They said separation of church and state means the government can't stop religious expressions. We're not in charge of that. And then in 1947, in the case of Everson versus Board of Education, the Supreme Court said, hey, Jefferson gave us this eight-word phrase, a wall of separation between church and state. No court since 1947 has used the full 233-word letter or even given its context. They use an eight-word phrase. And now we're told, well, the government has to stop a kid from saying God at graduation because that violates separation of church and state. No. Separation of church and state was to make sure the government couldn't stop a kid from saying God at graduation, couldn't stop a nativity scene from being put up, et cetera. So that's the brief history of separation of church
and
state.
So how did that get so distorted? I mean, who was responsible for the really upside-down sort of quality of that ruling?
Justice Hugo Black is the one who delivered the opinion in Everson in 47, and at that point in time, we had our courts filled with very progressive justices, whether it be Stevens or Earl Warren or others. And they all said, yep, it's time to evolve the Constitution. We don't need to be bound by what they believed 200 years ago. Let's get something different cooking. And so it really was what we call legal positivism. It's what in the Gore-Bush debates in 2000, it's what Al Gore called the living Constitution. We don't care what the written stuff says. We are in charge of changing it. And so it's an evolving Constitution.
Hold on that thought, David, because I've got to take a break. Much more with David Barton. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're talking with David Barton. He these days runs Wall Builders. But David, you were just mentioning that as recently as 3 weeks ago, there was a ruling by this current Supreme Court that may actually get us back to, you know, where we started from. And departed from to our great detriment. Tell us about it.
Yeah, what happened was after the court changed the definition of separation of church and state, then it had all of these religious practices that we've been doing for 200 years that are suddenly coming to the court saying, wait a minute, we've been doing these for 200 years, but under your new definition of separation, can we do this anymore? And so the court suddenly was facing so many religious liberty cases. There was one in 19. They made that switch in 1947, and then in 1948 here came a case. 1952 here came a case. All these cases started coming, and so by the time you get to 1973, they said, "Okay, let's give you a new test for what we're going to do here." And they called it the Lemon Test. The case was called Lemon v. Kirchman, 1973, and they said, "Here's the deal: a religious activity is constitutional if the primary purpose of that religious activity is secular." Now, I will challenge you to find any religious activity whose primary purpose is secular. You can't say the primary purpose of talking to God is secular. So suddenly we started losing everything that came forward because they said every religious activity is unconstitutional unless you can prove it's constitutional. And you just couldn't do that. Very few could you do. So that's where we've been religion hostile. But what happened in the Bladensburg case, where you had a war memorial, 100 years old, erected in St. George's County, Maryland, to honor 49 guys who died from St. George County in World War I. Now you're saying, hey, we've got to tear down a cross, because you can't argue the primary purpose of a cross at a war memorial is secular. You just can't do that, because there's so many other symbols you could use for a war memorial that aren't a cross. therefore, why don't you use a round globe, or why don't you use the letter W upside down, anything? How can you argue that the primary purpose of a cross is secular? You can't. And so now the courts are in the position of tearing that down, and that is also in the district of Arlington Cemetery. So if you order this cross down, you're now saying the national cemeteries, et cetera. And so what happened in this decision with the new justices in the court that President Trump has put there, they said, here's the deal. We are now going to go back to what we used to believe, and that is that every religious activity in public is constitutional unless you can prove it's unconstitutional. Wow, now we're saying exact sea shift. Instead of everything being unconstitutional, we're now going to say every religious activity in public is constitutional unless you can prove it's not. And that default, I mean, that will change. We're going back to something that the people in this generation, unless you were born back in the 1940s, you've never seen what's about to happen in America. But we're going back to what the Founding Fathers envisioned, back to what the Constitution gave us. And we will have a much more open religious society. We expect one more case to come to the court next year that will reverse one more of these really bad standard decisions, whether suddenly, because we can't go to the case now and argue religious expression. We have to argue free speech. And so we have to argue that free speech in religion has got a secular purpose. Well, we're about to find out that, you know what? You have the right to exercise your religion because the First Amendment guarantees you your free exercise. And so you can have religious speech just because it's religious. It doesn't have to be secular anymore.
David Barton, Thomas Jefferson, of course, gained some prominence, shall we say, when a congressman by the name of Keith Ellison was the first to swear his oath of office on Thomas Jefferson's Koran. And it was widely reported at the time that this was evidence that Thomas Jefferson was actually something of an admirer of, devotee maybe even, of Islam, and that on that basis, this is a very important sort of touchstone for Muslims entering public life to connect with. Is that so?
Not at all. What Keith Ellison said and did was a repudiation of everything Jefferson said and did, but it's because we don't know our history that he got away with saying it. You have to go back to the end of the American Revolution. We finally defeated Great Britain, and one of the very first things Congress did after they ended the Revolution in 1783 was in 1784, they sent Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Ben Franklin to go negotiate with five Muslim nations who are randomly committing terrorist attacks against Americans overseas. So see if you can find out what's going on, see if we can get this stopped. So Jefferson begins negotiations. Jefferson, Adams, and Franklin begin negotiations. After 2 years, Jefferson and Adams have a good relationship with the Muslim negotiator, and the five nations at that time were called Tunis, Algiers, Tripoli. You had Turkey, and you had Morocco. Those were the five trouble nations, North African kind of nations that were just randomly going after American flags when they saw it on commercial ships going to the Mediterranean. So Jefferson and Adams finally asked this Muslim ambassador, said, why do you guys do this? We have never done anything to Muslims in our life. We've had Muslims in America since 1619. We have never targeted the Muslims. Why are you doing this? And Jefferson wrote the answer out, sent it to the State Department. You can read this letter online at the State Department, the original letter. He said, the Muslim ambassador told us that this is required by the Quran. The Quran requires that, and if they kill us in battle, they go to heaven, and if they slave us, it went through all the Muslim doctrines. And Jefferson said, wait a minute, you're telling me that if you kill people, you go to heaven? I don't believe it. That's when he went and bought a two-volume set of the Quran. He was in London. It's a 1764 edition. He read that Quran to say, do they really believe this? Jefferson, and this is the benefit of being a thinker, not a learner, Jefferson wants to see this for himself. So he sees this. It now gives him a whole different view of what Muslim believes, because he's now seeing this, and he's negotiating with the guy who's saying this, and this is actually what they're doing to Americans. So we set up a system where we say, you know what, guys, if we pay you $1 million a year and build you three frigates out of the shipyard in Boston, will you not attack us this year? Yeah, we'll do that. And so they arrange these treaties with these Muslim nations that we pay them a lot of money. if they will not attack us. Well, by the seventh year of Washington's administration, he had had it with paying all this bribery extortion money. And so he
and they
said,
were still attacking us even so, were they not?
They were still attacking us. That's right. Even though we were paying, they were still attacking. And Washington makes a statement, "Would to heaven that I had a navy able to crush these enemies of mankind into non-existence." At that point, the Congress appropriated money for a navy. It was built under John Adams. Thomas Jefferson becomes president in 1801, has the navy now at his disposal, and he has this little badge that comes up, says, "Millions for defense, not a penny for tribute." We refuse to pay this because at that time, paying Muslim terrorists had become 15% of the federal budget. Single biggest line item we had, paying Muslim terrorists. He loads up the Marines on the Navy ships, goes and whacks them for 5 years, and says, "This is how you deal with Muslim terrorists." So Keith Ellison has no idea what he's talking about when he said the Quran had a great influence on Jefferson. It did, but it showed him how to fight those enemies, how to fight the terrorists.
Hey, David, very quickly, I was at the State Department yesterday and was regaled by Muslims who were telling us that there's no violence in the Quran, that it's all about peace and love. And they're determined, it seems, they and their friends on the left, to silence those of us who point out that's not so. How serious a threat are we facing now to the practice of freedom of speech in America?
Well, there's no question that Sharia law isn't compatible with constitutional protections. Only biblical precepts have constitutional protection for freedom of speech. Whether you look at what Elijah did with the prophets of Baal or whether you look at what Joshua did, they all said other religions can have their expression. You're going to have to choose. Do you want the Lord or do you want the other religions? You do not get that choice under the Sharia law system. And so when Jefferson finished defeating the Muslims in 1805, and 1806 is when the first American Quran came out, and it was to explain why we've been at war with these guys. And in the front of it, it says, you just need to read the Quran for yourself. If you do, you'll see why Sharia law is so contemptible to constitutional principles. So these guys like to go around saying, oh, none of this is compatible with your peace. All right. Back in the day, Jefferson wanted everybody to read the Quran and see for themselves that the principles of violence are there, that it's incompatible with constitutional protections. So while they have their evangelists out trying to convince people that this is not a big deal, back in the day we said every American needs to read the Quran for yourself, and then you will see the violence that it advocates, the principles that are there that are not consistent with the American Constitution.
We have to leave it at that. David Barton, this time has flown by. What an exciting conversation. I hope you'll come back for more of it soon, David. I hope to talk to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.